Hello, and welcome to Friends for Life, a podcast of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's National Mission. We're here to come alongside you as we journey through life under the cross. What does it look like to care for our neighbors in body and soul? How do we tend to our own body and soul? How can we speak up for life? And finally, how do we share the faith with the next generation? Join us as we have these conversations and learn together. We hope you'll stick around and be our friends for life.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Steph Neugebauer, here with my guest, Dr. Donna Harrison. Dr. Harrison, welcome back. We have had you on the show before, but for those who may be their first time listening or who haven't heard your voice in a while, would you please reintroduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I'm Dr. Donna Harrison, and thank you, Stephanie, for having me back. I always enjoy being on this podcast. I'm Dr. Donna Harrison. I'm an OBGYN, board certified for 30 years, currently retired from clinical practice, but actively involved in the issues that we're about to talk about. So I was the CEO Emerita for the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. I'm currently their director of research. And a lot of our research looks at the abortion pill.
Which is our topic today. So thank you for coming on to be our subject matter expert on this very issue. I have a lot of questions, and I cannot assume what our listeners know or don't know. And so I'm looking forward to learning alongside our listeners about how the abortion pill and access to the chemical abortion has changed the overall landscape of the abortion industry of quote-unquote reproductive rights and healthcare for women. So first of all, can you tell us how the abortion industry, the abortion landscape has changed in the last maybe 5 to 10 years with options and accessibility for abortions?
Sure. It's pretty scary, actually. The abortion drug, I'll just do a little background because I don't know where people are coming from, but the abortion drug is not one drug, it's two drugs. And the first drug is a drug called mifepristone, and that causes the baby to starve because it prevents the mom from feeding the baby. The second drug, misoprostol, causes the mom's womb to contract to expel the baby. So really, those are two drugs that are used simultaneously with each other. Well, they're 2 days apart, but they're used in conjunction for what's known as mail order abortion. So what's changed is when this first regimen was first approved by the Food and Drug Administration, what you had was minimal, very minimal safeguards involved for women. And those are just reasonable safeguards, not even all that could be applied. But one of them is that you meet with the doctor ahead of time so that he or she actually makes a diagnosis. Are you actually pregnant? Where's the pregnancy located? And this was supposed to happen before any kind of drug was administered. In 2016, those safeguards were relaxed, and in 2023, the allowance for mail order abortions was given wide open confirmation by the administration then in power. So what you have right now is basically the Wild West of abortion. It's basically do-it-yourself abortion, mail order, with minimal to no interaction with any kind of a medical professional. So there is no way in creation you could call this healthcare at all. It's really drug pushing, and those people who are supplying the drugs have no liability and no really doctor-patient relationship at all with the patients. So now you can go online, you can order mifepristone, which is the first drug of the abortion regimen that causes the baby to starve. You can order that if you're 12 and have a credit card. There's no questions asked. There's no confirmation that the baby is actually, that you're even pregnant, or that the baby's actually inside your womb. You know, one out of 50 women, when they become pregnant, have the baby implant in their tubes. It's called an ectopic pregnancy. If you take this drug and your baby is implanted in the tubes, this drug does not stop the baby from growing. What happens is the baby continues to grow and then the tube ruptures. And the symptoms of a rupturing ectopic pregnancy are exactly the same as the symptoms of a Mifeprex abortion, pain and bleeding. So there have been women, I've actually reviewed with a team of other physicians, the minimal reports that have been sent to the FDA. And there have been several women who had pain and bleeding called in. They were told, honey, take a Tylenol and go to bed. Call us in the morning. They died because their ectopic pregnancy ruptured and they hemorrhaged to death inside. Nobody should ever get mifepristone if they have an ectopic pregnancy. But the only way to tell if you have an ectopic pregnancy or a pregnancy in your womb is to have an ultrasound. And you can't do an ultrasound with a telemedicine visit. There's just no way to do it. You have to actually physically be there in person. So the whole provision of abortion is just a mockery. It's a parody of actual medical care. In actual medical care, you as a physician have a responsibility to make an accurate diagnosis. That is, tell the woman, are you pregnant? Are you not? Where's the baby? How far along the baby is? And then discuss with her risks and benefits. None of that happens with the telemedicine abortion. All that happens is drugs for money. It's drug pushing. And this is the dangerous thing. So women are being lied to that this is, quote, safe and effective. And the only reason that it's, quote, safe and effective is that a drug has to be, quote, safe and effective in order to stay on the market FDA approved. But the fact is it's a dangerous drug. And it's a dangerous regimen. And not only women who are pregnant who want an abortion are getting it, but women who don't want an abortion because there's nothing to stop their boyfriend or their mother or someone else, a disgruntled rival, from getting these drugs and surreptitiously administering. There have been a number of high-profile cases in the media. Just Google forced abortion or coerced abortion, and you'll see it. And so this is a drug of abuse, and women are the second victims of this madness, which is not medical care.
For one, you mentioned already several different cases that you could Google or have access to. Tell us, just from the standpoint of any woman who has access to these drugs, what are some of the dangers and specific risks that happen when, well, either she has a telemedicine appointment or these drugs are acquired for her from a boyfriend, husband, what have you? How is she putting herself in danger?
Yeah, the putting of herself in danger, you know, really depends on whether she even knows that she's getting these drugs. So there's a huge, huge capacity for coercion here, for coerced abortion. And if you look even at, if you Google reasons women abort, And even go to the Guttmacher website. Alan Guttmacher is the pro-abortion research group. If you go there and you look at the reasons women abort, it will break your heart. I didn't have support. I didn't have money. I had no one to take care of my kids. You know, it's not like this is empowerment. This is coercion at a very deep level. So women who are pregnant need us to surround them with love and care, real concern, you know, real help. For real needs. And so what you have with this willy-nilly use of abortion is you have an opportunity for other people to abuse her, to coerce her, and that's what's happening. So what risks does she face? Well, the way the abortion drug works is that it prevents a hormone called progesterone that a woman's body makes to support the pregnancy. It prevents that hormone from doing its job in the woman's body. And there are progesterone receptors in the brain, the breast, the immune system, the ovaries, as well as the lining of the womb. And mifepristone blocks progesterone receptors in all those places. That's one reason why there have been some women who have died from a very rare bacterial infection called Clostridium sordellii. It's actually much more common after a mifepristone abortion than it is in any other case because it affects the immune system. So multiple parts of a woman's body are affected. But that drug, mifepristone, the blockage, is the most effective, fails the least amount of time when the woman is just early pregnancy, like 2 weeks after she misses her period or three. So 2 or 3 weeks after she misses her period, assuming she has perfect cycles, which none of us do. So 2 or 3 weeks after, then you have about 5%, which is about 1 out of 20 women, who will then end up not having a complete abortion. They'll have tissue left inside, or there'll be hemorrhaging or some other complication. But the further along she is in pregnancy, the higher the risk. So you go from 1 out of 20 women in early pregnancy to, by the time you're 12, 13 weeks, 1 out of 3.
Oh.
1 out of 3. So it's critically important that she know exactly how far along she is. That's why if you were going to do this horrendous thing, you would at least do an ultrasound to find out how far along she is. Because without knowing how far along I am, I have no idea what my risks are. And if somebody is starting a treatment, and I use the term treatment loosely, giving me an intervention, giving me a drug, and they can't tell me how far along I am, they can't give me informed consent. Informed consent is a right of every patient, every patient. It's what malpractice lawsuits are based on, informed consent. So what you have with Mifeprex, the willy-nilly distribution right now, is medical malpractice in any other field other than abortion. And the reason I say other than abortion is because for some reason we are blind to the fact that abortion, the way it's being done right now, is malpractice. No informed consent, no diagnosis. Who's there to treat her when she has a complication, like you talked about? Okay, so what are the complications? Well, many of the abortions have hemorrhaging, okay, a large amount of blood. And some of that hemorrhaging is severe enough to require a transfusion. Sometimes there's tissue left inside. In fact, that's not uncommon. And the further out you go in pregnancy, the more common it is. So that's why women who are 12, 13, 14 weeks, that's why 1 out of 3 need surgery, and often emergency surgery, to stop the bleeding, because the tissue's only partly released and not all of it. If there's tissue left inside, that tissue can become infected. So infection is another huge issue. And you can have other complications, like I talked about before, ectopic pregnancy. And, you know, we've got 3% of women have the baby outside the womb. So all of these are risks, and all of these should be discussed. And all of these, the woman's specific risk depends on how far along she is. And the only way to tell that early in pregnancy is an ultrasound. So that's why this whole idea of dispensing willy-nilly with no medical care, no medical supervision, puts women at huge risk for bleeding, infection, need for emergency room visits, and even death.
Do you know what number or what percentage of abortions occur chemically rather than surgically?
Well, we think by reported numbers, voluntarily reported from abortion providers, so for whatever that's worth, we think that it's over half, so 65-70% right now.
Wow, so that's not just a small percentage of women.
No, it's a huge percentage. And that is not counting women who are getting the drugs online outside of an abortion provider. Okay, so that's not counting women who go online and order it from overseas. Oh, the other thing I should talk about, there was a study looking at this mail order abortion. And you had a large percentage of the drugs came with no label, no instructions, and a fairly significant percentage of the drugs didn't even have the right amount of drug. Okay, so when you order from overseas, you don't know what you're getting. You have no idea. And you're intervening in a natural process. God made moms and babies to stick together until the baby's ready to be delivered. So when you interfere with that, and you shred off pieces of the placenta, you're going to have trouble. I mean, that's just the way the design is. Women were not meant to separate from their babies, you know, before the baby is ready to live outside.
Well, and if I can just share too, with my over, you know, 15 years of working in pregnancy centers and providing ultrasounds for these women, it's vital and it's necessary for women to determine how far along they are and therefore how old their growing baby is inside of them, because a majority of these women who I perform ultrasounds on, are either unsure of their last menstrual period, and so we aren't working with accurate dating, or just have irregular periods, and so it makes it very difficult to track. And so I would say a majority of the time, these women are surprised at, oh, I'm earlier than I thought, or I'm farther along than I thought. Yeah. And pointing back to what you said, if these drugs are actually designed to work most effectively 2 to 3 weeks after, do you say, their missed period?
Right.
Which would be approximately 6 to 7 weeks past exactly. your last menstrual period. So by ultrasound right. dating, 6 to 7 weeks. And it becomes less effective and also more dangerous for these women as they approach 12 to 13 weeks. The very fact that we're working with a very small window of time in this woman's pregnancy, and the fact that it's important for her health to right. know how far along she is in pregnancy. And so why do you think, Dr. Harrison, that these safeguards for in-person evaluation and also ultrasound evaluation, why do you think that these were stripped from this process, which is, as I will add, a very standard process for a lot of medications that come with possible dangerous side effects? This is REMS. This is right. risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. And these are associated with a lot of drugs out on the market, not just abortion drugs. So why did the government say, let's do REMS on a number of other drugs out there, but let's strip some of these major safety procedures from the abortion drug?
Well, that is a wonderful question, which I wish I could answer. I'm old enough and cynical enough to say, follow the money. This is a very lucrative drug for abortionists. It allows the abortion industry to not hire physicians to supervise any of the abortion. They can hire anybody. It allows the abortion industry to not take care of women when they have a complication. So just for example, you talked about risks. Normally, if we were managing, say, the most comparable thing would be miscarriage, okay? So if you had some bleeding in early pregnancy and you called your doctor and said, hey, I think I have some bleeding, I think I have a miscarriage, what's the first thing your doctor would say? Take mifepristone and misoprostol and call me in 2 weeks? No. They'd say, please come in today, we'll do an ultrasound, we'll make a diagnosis. And then base a treatment plan based on that. Let's say the baby's still alive and you go home and there's no treatment and you have more bleeding. You're going to call your doctor or the person on call. There's going to be somebody that you can reach. And if you have bleeding enough to go to the ER, then after you call your doctor, what's the doctor going to do? They're going to call the ER and say, Stephanie Neugebauer is coming in. She's, 6 weeks pregnant by an ultrasound on Monday. She's having bleeding. I want the equipment ready. By the time you hit the ER, everybody knows what to do. Okay. Contrast. You get these abortion drugs online. What are you going to do when you start hemorrhaging? Who are you going to call? Call the abortion number, the abortion clinic. Thank you. The abortion clinic's closed. Please go to your local ER. You go to the ER. Nobody has your records. Nobody knows how far along you are. Nobody knows. And there's delay and delay and delay. And you are in trouble. This is really abysmally poor medical care. I mean, like I said, this is malpractice. If you did this kind of thing with a miscarriage, it'd be malpractice. No, hands down. And yet the abortion industry is getting away with this kind of negligence. And I think that it's time for women to say, enough is enough. This is negligence. This is not medical care.
So what's touted, by the abortion industry as we're protecting your privacy, we're giving, rapid access to health care that these women, quote unquote, vitally need. That's what they hear. Right. How is it neither of those things?
Well, first of all, it's not healthcare. Pregnancy is not a disease. And the fact that they're pushing drugs on somebody, oftentimes the woman's coerced, not being given a lot of time to think about it. So they're pushing drugs, and then they have no responsibility. The only person that abortion is safe for is the abortionist. So it's safe for the abortionist. It's just not safe for the woman that takes it. And it's certainly not safe for the baby that dies in the procedure. So it's a lie from the beginning. From beginning to end, it's a lie.
Dr. Harrison, can you speak to any kind of long-term studies? I'm sure they're very minimal, if at all, about the outcomes long-term for these women who have undergone chemical abortions. And not only the physical outcomes, but also perhaps the emotional and spiritual outcomes for these women. What are the implications?
Well, we know we have more data on surgical abortion. It's still an abortion. It's the ending of a pregnancy. And we know that, especially for mental health issues, that having an abortion increases the risk of suicide, drug abuse, and hospitalizable major depression. And there were big studies done, including by pro-abortion researchers who said, hey, the data is what the data is, and there is no mental health reason for having an abortion. It worsens mental health. In fact, it's recognized as a risk factor, you know, mental health disability is not an indication for an abortion. So for mental health, it's really pretty clearly established. And I'll tell you, I've exhibited at a lot of medical conferences, mostly hostile, right? And when we get on the issue of how do women fare mentally afterward, nobody disputes that women do terrible mentally after an abortion because of this increased risk of suicide, drug abuse, and depression. And I actually, when I first heard about it, I wasn't sure, does this really make sense? And then I saw a study out of Finland looking at suicide rate, just all-comer suicide rate, 4 times as high with women who abort.
Wow.
And not just that, but the timing of the suicide was anniversary. It's when they had the abortion, and it's when the baby would have been due. And so you get peaks of suicides for women that have abortions around those 2 times, the time of the abortion. And that's exactly what you would expect if there was an association between the abortion and the suicide. So that's really well established. For surgical abortion, there is an increased risk of preterm birth in subsequent pregnancies. And what does that mean? Well, that means losing a baby at 22, 23, edge of viability, okay, having the baby born then. Why? Because when you open up the cervix, you tear tissue that weakens the cervix. And when you scrape off the placenta, the mom feeds the baby through the placenta, you can always leave little bits of it behind, which set up a chronic inflammation. And the risk factors for preterm birth are inflammation and cervical damage. So 170 plus studies over 50 years have shown that women who have surgery for an abortion have an increased risk of losing their baby right around the edge of viability in subsequent pregnancies. And then there's another association that is important, really important, but it's not a soundbite, so you're going to have to bear with me. And that is the association between abortion and subsequent breast cancer. What is that association? Well, we've known forever that women who don't get pregnant have an increased risk of breast cancer. Why is that? Because in going from a never-pregnant breast to a breast that makes milk, there are changes that happens in the breast tissue that makes the breast cancer-resistant. Okay, so that's why nuns get breast cancer and women that never get pregnant. Well, it turns out that the breast tissue in the first pregnancy, you get a huge growth of breast tissue. That's that breast tenderness that you feel. That tissue is cancer-susceptible tissue. It takes taking a baby past 20 weeks for the placenta to start making a hormone that causes the breast tissue to change to be able to make milk. Okay, so milk-producing tissue, permanently cancer-resistant. Before the breast can make milk, that breast tissue is called type 1 and 2, cancer-susceptible. So when you abort a pregnancy, or actually if you lose a pregnancy for any reason, automobile accident, doesn't have to be abortion, but you lose a pregnancy for any reason, before 32 weeks, you've got a majority of your breast arrested in a state where it's cancer susceptible. Why do I say 32 weeks? Because around 32 weeks, you get 50% of the breast that's capable of making milk. That's why women that deliver babies at 22, 23 weeks they can't make much milk. It's got to be supplemented from the outside. But when you get past 32 weeks, then you've got sufficient milk-producing tissue to make enough. So that's the issue. Now, if you abort and then you immediately get pregnant afterward and bring that pregnancy to term, you've matured your breast tissue. It's not just the fact of the abortion. In fact, almost all the breast cancer risk factors boil down to two questions. How much cancer susceptible tissue do I have? And how long have I had it? So you don't see this association in women who've had 2, 3, or 4 babies and then abort. Okay, you just don't see it because most of their breast tissue is already cancer resistant. You see it in the women who abort a first pregnancy and delay having another child for 10, 15 years. You also see it in women who abort and abort and abort and abort and never have a term pregnancy. And we know from other research that we've done, when you look at what happens with the first pregnancy, if the woman who aborts a first pregnancy, a third of those women will never have a baby. They may get pregnant again, but it'll be followed by abortion. If a woman gives birth to her first pregnancy, two-thirds of those women will never have an abortion. That first pregnancy, the outcome of the first pregnancy, sets a trajectory. And so women who are in the trajectory of abort, 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 they're at huge increased risk of breast cancer. Women who have given birth and given birth and given birth, they're not. So that's why it's not a simple question, well, abortion and breast cancer. It's a matter of looking and understanding the breast is designed to make milk. You stimulate it without going to milk production, you make it cancer susceptible. That's kind of the bottom line.
I think it's helpful when we're having these conversations to talk not only in terms of numbers or just this vague idea of studies or a number of women, but to think in your head about a certain woman, and she doesn't have to have a face. But when I think about chemical abortions, I think about a teenage girl who has access to these drugs, who perhaps she follows all the instructions in the packet. You know, maybe she has access to that. And she's alone in her bedroom, and she starts cramping, and she starts bleeding. And perhaps she passes fetal tissue or the embryo in the bathroom, and she sees the blood, and she sees a baby. And I think about the trauma that must be for her to face that alone without knowing, well, how do I handle this now? And someone who's underage especially, are they likely to go to the emergency room so that they're exposed, their actions are exposed? I mean probably not. And so I have a lot of compassion and a heart for these women who feel like this is their only out. And I thank you for bringing the scientific backing behind why this is dangerous. And I also think if you would take a couple of minutes to speak to kind of the spiritual danger that she also is putting herself in, and the great vocation that God has given us in motherhood. So I guess my question would be this. What do you think the Christian response is, not only for this larger picture of this problem, but also for an earthy level? This is my sister in Christ. Perhaps someone is in my congregation. How does the church care?
Well, boy, that's a huge topic. And I've thought a lot about it because I think we're not serving maybe our sisters in Christ the way we could be serving them. So what does she need? Well, first of all, she needs to hear the forgiveness of sins. Because remember, Satan's the first one in line to tempt us to do something wrong, and then the first one in line to accuse us. So the moment she does that, and she thinks about going back to church, what she's going to get tempted to say is, I can't, because I've done something wrong. And I think there's a way in which I've talked to pastors about this and other women about this. There's a way in which abortion becomes the unforgivable sin because a lot of pastors won't talk about it. So if pastors talk about everything else, murder, divorce, whatever, and they won't talk about abortion, well, there's no hope for me, you know, because it's not a... And then I think there's another thing that we could do. It's going to be really hard for that woman, that sister in Christ, young sister in Christ, to identify someone in her congregation that could bring her the gospel, okay, that could bring comfort to her, that could walk with her through this repentance and forgiveness and grieving. I know that's the pastor's job. I know that. But if you think about the difficulty, it's going to be difficult for a young girl, even an older woman, to go to her male pastor. I don't think there should be female pastors, okay? Don't mishear me. But to go at that point and to talk about this, especially if they're not at the point of spiritual maturity to be able to do that. Okay, so I think there's a real need in congregations to identify female person who's trained in counseling. Okay, I think it's, you know, can be, I don't have the definition of what exactly the training should look like, but somebody in the congregation who can keep confidentiality, who can be trusted, who can act as an interface to bring this girl from the depths of despair back to hope, and then to the sacrament of reconciliation. You know, there's a need for that, and I don't know what that looks like. You know, I'm just telling you what I see as a need. I don't have the solution. I see the problem. So we've got to have that interface. Now, maybe that's a women's group. Maybe that's older women reaching out to younger women. It's just it's really difficult to know, and it probably is congregation specific and even person specific. But I think that's what we need to be aware of as women, is how do we identify the one that's hurting, and how do we come alongside them, put our arms around them, and say, let me walk with you to reconciliation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Thank you. And I think, you know, Paul really encouraged churches to be like this and act like this for older women who are hopefully wiser and more mature in the faith, to be in some way shepherding the younger women, to look out for them and to care for them and to encourage them in their vocation, whatever that would be, sister, as friend, if they're a wife, how to do that in a godly way. And so I think what you did is painted the kind of perfect picture of ultimately what that could look like. And let it be done among us, you know, in whatever way that is in our own congregations. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I think we could learn something by looking at reasons women abort. Okay, so there are risk factors that set up a woman for an abortion. Job loss, single parenthood, no house. You know, these kinds of socioeconomic things that make it difficult to parent are the same socioeconomic things that push women to say, this is better. You know, and so trying to be sensitive to those women who are in these situations of, you know, abandonment or economic downturn or whatever, and come around them before they get in a situation where they see abortion as a solution, which it isn't. It's just worsening the problem.
If you had an idea of a way forward, like for chemical abortion to not be a thing, to not be accessible. I do not think that on this side of Christ's return there is going to be a perfect answer. But what do you think could happen? I don't know. Would it be adding safeguards to the chemical abortion pill? Now, ultimately, again, we don't want abortions. But like, what would you be pushing for as a physician, as an OBGYN? What makes sense to you?
Well, what I would do as an OBGYN is a little different than what I would do as a devoted Lutheran. Okay, so if you want the OBGYN, this is not medical care. You hold the abortionist to the same standards that you hold everybody else to, which is you make a diagnosis in person, you give informed consent in person and person-specific, you are there to handle the complications. That would probably eliminate 95% of the abortions, to be honest with you. You've got abysmal care, and I'm not even going to call it medical care. It's a charade. So as an OBGYN, that's what I would call for. As a devoted Lutheran, I would say we need some deeper understanding of what it means to be a temple of the Holy Spirit, your body. What is this one flesh relationship? How do we safeguard it? How do we as a whole community of faithful devoted Lutherans say, you know, among us there isn't a hint of fornication or, you know, salacious talk or you know, the whole Ephesians thing. So we need to strive for that Ephesians thing. It's an Ephesians moment. We need to have communities where we say, hey, we're going to talk about this, and we don't do this. And this is why we tell you as a young man, don't have sex, not before you're married. And as a young woman, don't have sex before you're married. You know, save this particular one flesh relationship for one person. But by not talking about it, or by going ahead and saying, oh, well, you know, it's really okay, whatever you do, God forgives you. Yes, he does forgive you. But you can do incredible damage to yourself and your family. Look at David. He was forgiven, but the sword never left his house. So I think we need to really come to a point of a deeper understanding of what this marital relationship is, why we save it for one person, and then it's good, right, and salutary to save bodily intimacy for one person. There's billions of reasons why. So I think we need to be striving for that Ephesians moment in the Lutheran Church. I think we need to be calling medically the abortionists to accountability for their malpractice. And that's what I'd say.
Thank you, Dr. Harrison, I should say.
No,
thank you, Dr.
Donna
Harrison,
Swine.
So much for coming on, for sharing with us, and for giving us wisdom in how to care for these women, and also pointing us to Christ's way of life for his church and for the family. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
And thanks so much to our listeners for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review and don't forget to click the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss out on upcoming episodes. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at LCMS Life. And finally, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have an idea about a guest you'd like to hear from or a topic you want talked about? Email us at friendsforlife@lcms.org. We want to hear from you about what you want to hear about when it comes to issues of life.
Thanks for joining us. Friends for Life is a podcast that discusses the life God has given and the people he has called you to serve, right where you are, in God's mission.